Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Tonight, a conversation with State Senator Mark Leno, the man and his politics and his thoughts on the current state of San Francisco. Mark Leno, originally from Milwaukee, the grandson of Russian Jewish immigrants, moved to San Francisco in 1977. He was appointed to San Francisco's Board of Supervisors in 1998, was elected to the California Assembly in 2002, and to the State Senate in 2008. He's the first openly gay man to serve in California's Senate. Leno, a Democrat, has been a strong supporter of LGBT issues throughout his political career. In 2005, 10 years ago, then-Assemblyman Leno authored a bill to legalize same-sex marriage. It became the first bill of its kind to pass a legislative body in the U.S. It was vetoed by then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The same fate befell a similar bill Leno introduced 2 years later. Since then, he's sponsored many bills to advance LGBT rights, including this year alone, one on respecting gender identity and foster youth placement, and another on equal benefits and state contracting for transgender employees. He's far from a single-issue politician, though. Leno is co-sponsor of a climate change bill calling for a 50% reduction in petroleum use in cars and trucks, a 50% increase in energy efficiency in buildings, and a goal of half of all state utilities' power coming from renewable energy by 2030. And he has authored or is working on bills addressing San Francisco's eviction crisis, affordable housing, the statewide minimum wage, e-cigarettes, homeless youth, and online privacy. Leno currently chairs the Senate's powerful Budget and Fiscal Review Committee. What makes Mark Leno tick, and what will he do after he's termed out of the state Senate next year? Stick around to hear from Senator Leno on his lawmaking priorities, his thoughts on how far the LGBT community has come, and what work is left for us. For example, what's key now that marriage equality is the law of the land? And after representing San Francisco residents for 17 years, what's the state of our city, and what can we do to meet our challenges? State Senator Mark Leno, representing California's 11th State Senate District, covering much of San Francisco and part of San Mateo County, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you, Eric. Good to be back in your studio. I think the last time I was at the KALW studios was with Alan Farley. He had invited me for his My Favorite Things show. So he asked me to play 10 of my favorite musical pieces and talk about them. What a great pleasure that was. And of course, with Alan, who knew so much about everything.
The late, great Alan Farley. Yeah. What do you remember what some of your favorite records were that you brought in?
Gosh, you know, it must have been from Stravinsky's Rite of Spring to The Intruders, I'll Always Love My Mama, probably with some Dan Hicks and Laura Nyro thrown in.
Fantastic. So before we talk about your bills in the state legislature this session, I want to get to know you a little bit, and our listeners too. What brought you to San Francisco back in 1977?
1977. I think we were all young then.
Yes.
And I had been in New York City for about 4 years, a couple of them as a rabbinical student. I was at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, a reform seminary. Actually thought I wanted to be a rabbi at that time. Subsequently dropped out, so I'm a rabbinic dropout.
Mm-hmm.
And then one winter, I lost my job, lost my apartment, and the temperature kept falling. I had a sister out here in the Bay Area who said, she wrote me a letter, I remember clearly, she said, get out of that cold, old, dirty city, come out here and revivify.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. So I arrived in February of 1977. I've never looked back. It's been an extraordinary life here in San Francisco.
Did you know you were gay at that time? Is that part of the reason for your move?
I certainly knew I was gay, and I certainly knew somewhat of San Francisco and its history, and that it was a mecca for our community. I came out in 1969. I'm a Stonewall baby. I was around 18 at the time. And so that was already part of who I was.
Okay. I'm just curious, you know, is going to rabbinical school, is that something that gay Jews do? You know, like the gay Catholics seem to end up in seminary or not? I don't know if that's the many. It seems like the seminary, from what the stories I've heard, there's a lot of
it would
gay
seem.
Guys in there.
In fact, many former seminarians, whether gay or otherwise, have found their way into public service and some into elected office. No, in fact, though I considered myself out in my rabbinical class, if I had completed the program, which was 5 years of postgraduate work, and been ordained, I would have been the first openly gay ordained rabbi And it would have happened about 7 years before they actually did ordain someone. So I was a little bit ahead of that curve. And for me, part of the challenge was that there was no role model. There was no one I could look to see. And, you know, I was a 24, 25-year-old gay man at the time wondering, you know, can one be sexually active and be a rabbi and all sorts of questions that I just didn't have answers to and hadn't set on them within myself.
And did they in the school, did they know you were gay? And or was it an issue for you to even, you know, let people know about your life in rabbinical school?
You know, I remember going up the staircase of the school and there was a first year program in Jerusalem so that all of those coming from a variety of different academic backgrounds could get a certain level of Hebrew proficiency, which we would need for the textual studies that were going to follow in the years to come. And I was entering the school that first day, I'm thinking, as the administrative offices were looking down upon me, thinking, aren't we progressive? Aren't we advanced? Or they were thinking, oh, here comes another one.
Okay. How did you get into politics?
Through the back door. I never had a plan to run for public office. I never imagined I would. I knew a lot of people who were in elective office, and that's part of how I got through this back door. I raised money for candidates, subsequently raised some money for Willie Brown when he was running in 1995, and it was through his offer of an appointment to the County Board of Supervisors in 1998 that I got into it. I was very ambivalent, and I have such respect for people who know they want to be in public office and will stand out on a rainy corner on a cold night and convince you that you should support them and give them your time and money and effort. I was ambivalent about even a maybe possible potential appointment, but when I got into it, I realized, given that I had done absolutely no public policy work beforehand, I'd never seen a Board of Supervisors meeting, never attended one, that I was a closet policy wonk. I love public policy, and I had fallen in love, as I still am today, with the legislative process. It is maddening, it is fascinating, it is frustrating, but it is ultimately so exciting and a privileged opportunity.
Yeah. Whose seat were you filling?
Susan Leal had been elected county treasurer in November of 1997, and Willie announced at that time that he would replace her with a Latina lesbian. Mm-hmm. And you never saw the words Latina lesbian on the front page of the papers for so many months. It took him 5 months, and he couldn't find a Latina lesbian who would drop whatever she was doing to put in 80 hours a week at City Hall for $30,000 a year.
Right.
And he then said, I admit defeat, and I'm appointing Mark Leno.
Okay, great. You were a small businessman before that. You had a sign-making shop, right?
I started a sign company in 1978. We're still going.
Okay, so I didn't even know that it was still going. Okay. Great. You can put a plug for your business. Where do they find you? So you've been immersed in state politics for the last 12 and a half years since you joined the state assembly. And before that, I guess you served 4 years on the Board of Supervisors.
Right.
So as you look back on nearly 13 years of representing this community in Sacramento and earlier as a supervisor, what are your thoughts on the changes that San Francisco has seen? You know, so many people think that we're losing our city, that it's changed so drastically, especially in the last few years.
Well, certainly with regard to LGBT civil rights, when I got to Sacramento, California ranked nowhere near the top of states regarding legal protections for our rights. But after 10 years of work, and I do want to credit our statewide lobby, Equality California, who sponsored so many of our bills, that California is now number one. There is no state that has as many legal protections for our community now, of course, including marriage, than any other state. So we've come a long ways, and it was very much the same time I've been in Sacramento. But I'm also thinking back on a piece of local legislation that I authored in 1999-2000 when I was on the County Board of Supervisors. We had established a transgender civil rights implementation task force in 1999. And I underscore the word implementation because there had been public hearings on the needs of the transgender community in San Francisco in the mid-1990s. Then Supervisor Terrence Hallinan had held these hearings, and a report was done, had been put on the shelf, and nothing had been done with it since. But we knew that the transgender community experienced extraordinarily high rates of unemployment, lack of access to education, health care, housing, makes our lives as gay men look like a walk in the park, and I mean that sincerely, extraordinarily difficult life. And so we put this task force together, and the task force, made up of men and women from the transgender community, determined that equal access to the county health plan was the number one issue, equal access to health care being the biggest issue, but we thought we'd start at home in county government. So out of 28,000 or so county employees, there were maybe 20 transgender employees. But, and interestingly, I got my first invitation to be on Bill O'Reilly's show at this time to talk about this. And I didn't even know who he was at the time. My staff had to tell me and then said, of course, you do not want to go on his show and talk about transgender rights. I said, oh, I certainly do.
Good for you.
So I went on his show. And, of course, the first thing out of his mouth was, supervisor, why should my tax dollars go to pay for someone's sex change operation? And I said, well, Bill, that's actually not what we're doing. Let me tell you that if you're a non-transgender employee of the city and county of San Francisco and you need hormonal treatment or psychiatric treatment or a mastectomy or a hysterectomy, county health plan pays for 100% of it. But if you're a transgender employee in need of identical medical care, the plan will pay for none of it.
Hmm.
And when I finished, Bill O'Reilly said, supervisor, you make a compelling argument.
Wow. Well, good for you.
So I tell the story because it really does speak clearly to the fact that when we make it understandable to people what we're doing, what we're fighting for, yes, the bill may have paid for a gender reassignment surgery here or there, but it was about equal access to our county health plan. Two employees sitting side by side should get equal benefits for the work that they're doing. And just about everyone, including Bill O'Reilly, understands that.
Now, is that similar to the bill that you have before the in the state legislature this year that's about statewide contracting?
So, yes, it is about equal benefits. And San Francisco is actually a world leader in the whole concept of equal benefits. Going back to our domestic partners' equal benefits bill back in 1996-97. It just predated my time on the county board. So that since gay and lesbian couples could not marry at the time, though we did have domestic partnerships, that if a private business wanted to contract with San Francisco and provided, we didn't require them to provide anything, but if they provided a benefit to an employee that would benefit that employee's spouse, then that business had to provide an equal benefit to the domestic partner of a gay employee, equal benefits for equal work. And so this bill we're working on now, given that California requires any California business that contracts with the state must provide equal benefits. But when we're putting out a bid for some service or goods that the state needs, there are out-of-state companies that are vying for that contract. And the bill that we're authoring this year says that if you contract over $100,000 with the state of California, you must provide equal benefits, and we're talking mostly health care benefits, to transgender employees if you provide a benefit to non-transgender employees. And so it levels the playing field. Currently, our California companies have to comply with state law. They're unequally burdened with out-of-state companies that don't have to do this. We want to level the playing field, so it's good there. And also, of course, the righteous thing to do, we want to make sure that all transgender employees are getting equal benefits for equal work.
How is this being received on both sides of the aisle?
Thank you. Interestingly, there is no opposition, no formal opposition. No one's written a letter. The Chamber of Commerce, nobody's written a letter against it. So it's without opposition. But I don't know that we've got a Republican member voting for the bill yet. Often, all of our LGBT issues start off, when we begin somewhere, strictly partisan party line voting. Democrats support, Republicans oppose. Over time, a few of my Republican colleagues seem to be catching on, and the vitriol in their speeches on the floor in committee have really been toned down from the way it was 15, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. because at this point they're just embarrassing themselves. And you'd think they'd catch up at some point, because imagine, 20 years ago, they were arguing against hospital visitation rights mm-hmm. for domestic partners. You know, this is such a crazy thought. You would oppose that.
Yeah.
But now, you know, whatever the issue of the day is, such as, well, even equal marriage rights is yesterday's debate, not today's, they're still struggling with it, some of them. And I think it's more politics than belief, and they're afraid of their own shadow, because I don't think their constituents would have any issue with it if they supported equal rights for LGBT Californians.
You're listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is California State Senator Mark Leno. Special thanks tonight to Chris Eskra, associate producer for this edition of Out in the Bay, doing much of the research on Senator Leno's background and 2015 legislative agenda. So I want to talk a little bit more about San Francisco again. And, you know, when I asked about the changes, I wasn't talking about just LGBT rights, but this huge, the problems, the housing crisis we're having now, and this huge divide yeah. between rich and poor. We have so much wealth coming into the city, and so much desperation at the same time. I mean, we're seeing it everywhere. Is there a way the state can help this situation? Or,
well, there's certainly a way that the state is hurting the situation right now. Back in 1985, in response to a California Supreme Court decision the year before, the legislature passed something we now know as the Ellis Act. It was authored by a legislator by the name of Ellis. And it gave landlords, and I want to repeat that, it gave landlords a statutory right to be able to evict all tenants for the purpose of going out of the business of being a landlord. The court a year earlier had said there is no statutory right, and like any other business owner, if the landlord wants to get out of the business, sell the building, but you don't have a right to evict all tenants. The legislature gave landlords that statutory right, but for the purpose of going out of the business of being a landlord. And then they put some restrictions on it so you couldn't game the system. This would only have meaning in a rent-controlled city, that you couldn't then, after evicting everyone, re-rent within right. 5 years. So there were some restrictions put on it. But today we are seeing the Ellis Act abused, and I mean that very sincerely, abused. Not by landlords or people who even pretend to be or intend to be landlords. They're speculators. Mm-hmm. They buy buildings with the intent purpose, not of being a landlord, but to evict everyone so they can flip the property. Mm-hmm. And usually it's to subdivide and sell as tenancies in common, which is legal. Mm-hmm. But that's not what the Ellis Act was created for, and that's the abuse. Mm-hmm. And so we want to differentiate between who's a speculator and who's a landlord. My beef isn't with landlords. It's with speculators who aren't even pretending to be landlords.
Right.
And if you ask me what's the difference between a speculator and a landlord, I'd tell you very simply, a landlord's business is 100% occupancy. A speculator's business is 100% vacancy. Yeah, that's a big difference model.
Yeah.
So
well,
what our bill, and it's still alive, we'll take it up again in January. I'm looking for one vote, and it's quite possible I'm going to pick that vote up for a rehearing of the bill in January, get it out of committee into the Senate floor, and then over to the Assembly, would merely give San Francisco, and it's just a district bill just for San Francisco to address our unique crisis, for the Board of Supervisors with the signature of the mayor, to require the property owner hold the property 5 years before using the Ellis Act.
So in other words, they couldn't buy it and immediately invoke the Ellis Act. They'd
That's
have to
right.
hold
They'd
it
have
at least
to
5 years.
For 5 years. And we chose 5 years because nearly 70% or so of all these evictions happen within the first 5 years. Mm-hmm. And in fact, half of them happened within the first 12 months.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly seen and heard stories about it all over.
And, you know, we talk a lot about it. Where are we going to find the money mm-hmm. to build more affordable housing, and putting a burden on developers to require them to now, we started at 15%. In fact, I wrote the original ordinance back in 2000 requiring a percentage of all new market rate housing to have a percentage of below market rate affordable housing in those projects. And now we're pushing up to 30, a third of all projects must have affordable housing. But if we're losing our most valuable affordable housing stock, our rent-controlled units, then it's good that we're just treading water when we build new ones. And in fact, a recent report showed for every 10 new market rate affordable housing units, for every 10 affordable housing units that we're building right now, we're losing 8 to no fault evictions.
Wow. Okay.
Tenant does nothing wrong, and they lose their home.
Right, right. I know I've seen it happen to too many people.
Yep.
Now, this is my crazy idea that I know would never make it politically.
What's that?
But since I've got you know, as a captive audience, you know, there's been all this minimum wage and how
yes.
good that can be for low-income people. And my idea was, why don't we have a maximum wage here? If you can't buy, first I was thinking you can't live in the city if you earn more than, I don't know, $250,000. But now just talking, I think really what's even more important is, and I know, again, it's politically unfeasible, but restricting the purchase of real estate in San Francisco to those whose income or net worth is under a certain ceiling. Because then it seems like so much of this, as you said, is driven by speculation and pure profit. I hear these house flipping ads on certain commercial radio stations, and it just makes my blood boil that these stations pass themselves off as being San Francisco locally based stations, and they have ads for flipping houses.
Yeah. Well, we know we're in a very heightened economy right now. The good news, of course, is that unemployment is close to about 3.5%. But there's always a shadow side to these circumstances. We've been here before. Year 2000 wasn't that long ago when we saw the dot-com bubble burst and the suffering that came as a result of that. But one idea along your lines, Eric, that has not only been floated but put into legislative form. I was a co-author of a bill last year, if I can get the details right. It would give a tax incentive to corporations in California, which kept the differential between the median wage and the CEO's to no more than 100 times difference.
Wow.
And in fact, back in the Gilded Age of the 19th century, J.P. Morgan, of all people, argued that a differential of 20% was more than enough. Today, we're seeing 450 times greater the CEO's wage than the median wage in that CEO's company. So the idea was that for those corporations that would limit themselves to a differential of no more than 100 times, that they would get tax breaks from the state of California. So we incentivize them to do the right thing. It requires a two-thirds majority vote, and we have not been able to get there yet, but it is a very interesting idea.
Yeah, I'd say. So we have probably about 5 minutes left.
Yes.
So if there are a few other top legislative bills that you have as summer recess, as you come out of summer recess and the legislature reconvenes on August 17th, what are the ones that are close and you need support on?
Well, thank you. We are working on increasing California's minimum wage. 2 years ago, we were successful in raising the minimum wage for the state of California from $8 an hour to $9 an hour, which occurred in July of last year, July 2014. January 2016, it will go to $10 an hour. That's already in law, so it'll go to $10 an hour. But that comes out to about $20,000 a year.
Yeah.
The federal poverty line for a family of four is about $24,000 a year. So that is significantly below the federal poverty line, which doesn't account for the 30% higher cost of living here in California, nor does it even have a line item for the cost of childcare. So it's a very modest, conservative federal poverty line. I'm of the belief, and those who are supporting our increase of the minimum wage statewide, our belief is that it should not be legal to pay a sub-poverty wage in California. We have the highest rate of poverty in the entire nation. Almost a quarter of Californians are living below the federal poverty line. Almost a third of our children are. This is shameful. We could lift over 1 million people out of poverty, full-time working people, if we didn't pay them sub-poverty wages. So our bill would raise our minimum wage to $11 an hour in January of 2016, 18 months later to $13 an hour in July of 2017. That will finally get us to the federal poverty line. And then 18 months later, in January of 2019, adjust it to the consumer price index so that it won't fall below the poverty line going forward.
But the crazy thing is the federal poverty line is not made for cities like San Francisco.
Well, but it
is adjusted. Is it adjusted, you know, geographically?
No, it's not. But if, for example, the federal minimum wage is currently $7.25 an hour, if you can imagine that, and there are many states that don't have their own higher minimum wage. So the president's talking about $10.10 an hour for an increase in federal minimum wage. Adjust that by 30%. That would be $13 an hour. That would work pretty well for California. And then, of course, that would just be a floor for the state, and then cities and counties could certainly go above that, which is what we see occurring. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles, the city just raised its to $15 an hour. Los Angeles County just raised theirs to $15 an hour. San Francisco raised its to $15 an hour. Of course, it'll take a few years to implement it fully. But again, just getting back to a very basic premise, someone working full time should not be living below the poverty line.
And what kind of opposition do you face on that?
Chamber of Commerce says it's a job-killing bill. But if you look at what happened to California's unemployment rate since we raised our minimum wage from $8 to $9 an hour, going to $10 an hour in January of next year, we've seen our unemployment rate go from 7.6% down to 6.2%. There are studies that both sides of the argument will show our argument is right. But if you look at the facts, it does not kill jobs. In fact, when you put more money in working people's pockets, they have to spend it to pay the rent and keep food on the table. More dollars being circulated that will get spent in communities, that increases demand for goods and services. That's when employers have to hire more workers to meet the greater demand. And then more people are working, more people with more money in their pockets. And that's what economists call a virtuous upward cycle. And that's why a minimum wage increase actually benefits the economy. And I know it's a challenge for small business owners. I'm one myself. But it brings greater stability to the workforce, greater productivity, less turnover. You don't have to reinvest in retraining. And by increasing prices just minimally, you don't have to lay off workers and you can survive just fine. And there'll be more money coming through the door because everyone's got a little more money to spend.
As you approach your last year in the California Senate, you'll be termed out at the end of next year. What's next for you? Are we going to see Mayor Leno?
We're all beneficiaries of term limits. Of course, if it weren't for them, Willie Brown would still be in my old assembly seat. And then we all soon become victims. So it'll be tough to say goodbye to the state legislature, but it's also important to pass the baton to those coming up behind. And I don't know yet, Eric, what I'll be doing next, but I'll be sure to keep you informed.
No exclusive announcements on Out in the Bay, huh?
Not today, but I hope I can be back to share something with you.
Okay, very good. Mark Leno, I want to thank you so much for being here. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. It's independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW for studio use and airtime, and tonight's engineer Ashley Ann Kriegbaum. You can hear tonight's show, a year of past shows, and a dozen of our all-time favorites on our website, outinthebay.org, where you can also sign up for free podcasts and get the Stitcher app. That's right, Stitcher, that lets you hear radio programs on mobile devices. Also on our Plain Favorites page, you can find some of our personal favorites, including interviews with John Waters, Ang Lee, Leslie Gore, Phyllis Lyne, and the late Del Martin, Matthew Shepard's mother, Judy Shepard, and a feature on Liberace. That's outinthebay.org. As an independent production, not a KALW staff production, Out in the Bay receives no financial help from KALW. We depend on community support. It's easy and tax deductible on our website, outinthebay.org. Just hit the donate button and pitch in for queer air in your ear. And don't forget matching funds from your employer. Our theme music was composed and performed by San Francisco musician Holly Ann Mead. Learn more about Holly and her blog, hollymead.tumblr.com. Also want to say that Out in the Bay is proudly supported by Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Portola Valley, who hope their generous donation will inspire your contribution of any size. Thank you so much. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, comments, and questions. Write to us, Eric at outinthebay.com and Marilyn at outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen, and I am out of time.